Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Good morning, David Gura with Tom Keene on Bloomberg Surveillance. Wednesday, November the 9th, the day after Election Day 2016. And since the polls closed yesterday, we've kept one eye on the popular vote in the Electoral College, the other eye on the markets. Analysts said Donald Trump's path to the White House would be narrow. And when it looked like he was indeed on that path, winning Florida, giving Hillary Clinton a run for her money in Virginia, the sell-off began in earnest. The Mexican peso touching record lows overnight. Dow futures down more than 700 points from time to time. Around 2 a.m. Wall Street time, the announcement came from John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman, telling her stunned supporters at the Javits Center they would not hear from the Democratic candidate, not until every vote is counted. Donald Trump, for his part, did not wait. He spoke at his election night headquarters about an hour later, thanked those supporters, and made a conciliatory gesture or two to his opponent and her supporters. President-elect Donald Trump standing next to Vice President-elect Mike Pence. And now, 4 hours later, we're seeing futures down less dramatically than they were last night. S&P futures down 45 points. Dollar peso at 1989.12. And gold, which we're keeping an eye on all last night, at 1303.15. Joining us now in studio is Bob Hormats, Vice Chairman of Kissinger and Associates. Bob, great to have you here.
Great to be here. Morning. Thanks.
This played out just as you expected, I imagine.
This is a big surprise to me, a big shock. But now we have a new president-elect, and we have to figure out a way of making sure that he succeeds in dealing with the problems that the country faces and pulling the country back together. This country, it's not just divided, it's fractured. And healing this fracture is going to take a lot of work. Across party lines and within parties, because they're very, very strongly held views on in both parties that ultimately, if you're going to get any progress at all, you have to compromise on some things. I think there can be a deal on infrastructure, and I think both Clinton and Trump focused a lot on small business, and there are plans in the House Republican bill for lowering taxes on small businesses that could be very helpful to individual proprietorships or LLCs or individual companies, small businesses that now pay the individual income tax. If you lower taxes on small business, that can be very helpful. And I think there could be a consensus developed on that, for instance.
Among the things that we didn't talk about in much detail before last night was how Donald Trump would govern with a Republican Congress, Republican House, and Republican Senate. It does make things easier here, having Republican control of both those houses.
Yes, it does. On the other hand, the rule in the Senate is you have to get 60 votes to get legislation through, and therefore having a slight majority in the Senate doesn't guarantee you're going to get what you want. In addition, there are divisions between Ryan and the President-elect Trump on certain issues. So he's got to work out arrangements with Ryan and with others in the House to get the kind of things he wants. So he's going to, even though they're all Republicans, he still has to make deals with the House because they don't see things eye to eye with him. And on trade, he has a lot of authority. He's been delegated over decades, a huge amount of authority, and he can take action on trade without having to discuss it with the House. He may find it prudent to do so, but he has a lot of authority. And if he abuses that authority, if he does the kind of things he says he's going to do, as said he's going to do in the campaign, you could have a great many problems. Even if fiscal policy is sound, you could have a trade war if he decides to go after China, impose unilaterally a 45% tariff, or do the kind of things to abolish NAFTA. And I think what the market's more worried about is not so much his fiscal policy, because there are checks and balances and there are a number of people he has to work with to get fiscal policy through. He has almost unlimited, for the moment, powers on trade to take tough action. And And that could cause huge problems in the market if he pursues the policies he said. He could moderate them, and I think there would be people who would argue that they should be moderated, tougher lines, but not these kind of policies that would cause a trade war.
David Gura, for me, it was a telltale moment. Two things happened. Chris Matthews killed it on MSNBC with an analysis of the Philadelphia suburbs, and particularly Bucks County. And the other was the loss of your North Carolina. Mm. When for you, in the heat of the coverage last night, was the shift made?
It felt like for hours we were watching Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, and I was sitting next to Megan Murphy, as you mentioned, and she also was looking at Pennsylvania very closely. And the story through the night, when we were looking at Virginia as well, was about these suburbs, about these exurbs in Virginia. The story was similar in Pennsylvania as well. We talked about the dichotomy there, the two Pennsylvanias. Barack Obama had a lot of success bringing in massive votes in and around Philadelphia. It appears Hillary Clinton did not have the same success.
I agree, and it's so much a type two, not so much what Mr. Trump did, but the analysis, the postmortem of how Secretary Clinton performed. Robert Hormetz, you worked within the Obama administration and most directly with Secretary Clinton. How would you suggest she will move on after this stunning defeat?
Well, it's going to be tough. She is a tough person, though, and she's, I think, able to deal with difficult circumstances. But this one, I think she felt very good about running, and I think she felt that she had a very good chance of winning. But she also is not going to back off from playing a role in American politics, even if it's not as president. She has a number of strong views about issues, and I think she will weigh in. And I think if the president's wise, President-elect Trump is wise, he will sit down and talk to her and at least get some sense on some of the issues, perhaps issues on which they agree or could agree. We have to pull the country together. The fractured country, if it continues to be fractured from a political and a social point of view, we're not going to get very much done. One way he could do it is to reach out and talk to her and others in the Democratic Party. One of the things that was very interesting, when Eisenhower won a very controversial nomination in 1952, he ran against Taft. Taft was the one he defeated. On the floor of the convention, he walked over to Taft and said, look, we've got to sit down together. I think what Trump's going to have to do is be much more inclusive, talk to people in his own party like Ryan, who have a lot of doubts about some of his policies, but also have a dialogue with senior Democrats in order to get the country moving together. Not in every area. It's not going to work in every area, but in some areas, having a conversation with her and other Democrats is going to be important. If he wants to be get things done and he wants to be the president, the inclusive president that he mentioned he wanted to be last night.
A statement here from the White House, just crossing, a statement from the press secretary. From the White House residents, the president phoned Donald Trump to congratulate him on his victory early this morning. The president also called Secretary Clinton and expressed admiration for the strong campaign she waged throughout the country. Again, that just coming across it from the White House moments ago. Bob Hormetz, Donald Trump on the campaign trail said many times he was a candidate capable of change. Often in the face of criticism, he said he would act differently if he were to become president. Did you see signs of that last night in the speech that he gave? It wasn't a long speech. It wasn't a speech marked by sweeping rhetoric, but he was at points conciliatory.
The tone of what he said last night, however brief, as you say, was actually very constructive. And if he continues that tone, that notion of inclusivity, that he wants to be the president for all the people, that will be very important. Who he picks as his advisors, if he picks people who are pragmatists, that will be a very important signal that progress can be made. If he picks ideologues, it'll be much more difficult to make progress.
The White House saying here the president has invited President-elect Trump to meet him at the White House on Thursday of this week to update him on the transition planning his team has been working on for nearly a year as well. Just want to mention that too, Tom.
Bob Hormetz, very quickly, you are out of Baltimore, Maryland. I would suggest that Mr. Trump had the support, just as one example, of the Baltimore police officers, or many of them as well. He has a constituency which he has to meet with, and he has to address the people that voted him in and their needs. How will he express that in the first critical 100 days?
He does have to deal with his constituents. It's a constituency that feels marginalized. It feels that the elites have not paid attention to them, that the people who are running the country have really not dealt with their issues. So he's got to figure out a way of addressing some of the grievances that his constituents, the people who supported him, the movement, as he calls it, feel most strongly about. And that, I think, requires him to try to figure out ways of dealing with the tax issue. The tax issue at this point, I think, is probably not going to fly through the House, but he has to find some way of doing
Let's come back. Robert Hormats with us this morning. David Gura with me up until 2:30 or 3. Did you get any sleep at all?
Two and a half hours. Got back to the hotel
at
3.
That's about what I got.
A few winks.
Boo-hoo.
About what I got. John Tucker has been up for 48 hours, enlivening our views. Is Governor Christie called looking for you to take over as he goes to Washington?
You know, it's all seriousness, you got to wonder. It's just, with this mess that's going on in federal courts in Newark, where does it stop? And I don't think it has stopped.
That has come up
within
the media.
Tucker.
We've seen that as well. We welcome all of you nationwide, indeed around the world. For those of you around the world, this is remarkably American-centric this morning. And we're thrilled to have with us Robert Hormats, who has served administrations on both sides of the aisle, most recently directly with Secretary Clinton and President Obama at State. Bob Hormats, I guess we redefine the phrase flyover America. As David was mentioning on the break, the map looks a little different this morning. It is about demographics. It's about culture. It's about race. It's about a new America. And the establishment, you're a card-carrying member, must adapt.
The establishment has to adapt. I think you're exactly right. At first, it has to understand what's going on in middle America. We in New York, I think, live in a cocoon. We don't really understand what's going on in the Midwest and all these states.
Or on 11th Avenue, but continue.
Or on 11th Avenue, right. Or north of 96th Street. When I was Undersecretary of State for Economic Affairs, I made a point of going to various parts of the country that had been hit by the downturn, the Great Recession, Gary, Indiana, Hammond, Indiana, Hamtramck, Michigan, New Orleans. And there it was palpable that these people felt that they had not benefited from the recovery, that globalization was a threat, that the money that was spent to re-stimulate the economy had not helped them. It had helped Wall Street and big business. It had not helped them. They weren't getting any money. The financing wasn't there for them. Globalization was harmful to them. And new technology was displacing their jobs.
I know David wants to get in here. He's got a surveillance bagel in his mouth right now, which is helping out. Bob Hormats, help me here with your definition of Trump capitalism after what you've observed for the last 2 years.
Well, I think Trump capitalism essentially, as he has described it, is to lower taxes, not just on lower-income people, but upper-income people, hoping that that will stimulate more demand. That is probably his main thing. He also wants to do certain things that will help small businesses. The House Ways and Means Committee, Kevin Brady and the Speaker, have a very thoughtful plan to lower taxes for small businesses so that so-called pass-through income will be taxed at 15% and not the 39.6 individual tax rate. I think there are things that can be done that will pull Democrats and Republicans together. Everyone knows you need to do things to help small business. This, at least, is one area. There's also going to be a lot of focus on how do you repatriate the $2 trillion or so dollars that are held abroad. There are numerous plans being developed, again, in the so-called House Republican blueprint that can be utilized for this. I think there's going to be a lot of discussion of these kinds of things, whether they're in Trump's program or they're in the House Republican program or the Democratic program. There are areas where I think you can get some degree of harmony amongst the various parties and interests.
Bob, the burden of expectations here is heavy. Donald Trump was able to travel to Western Pennsylvania and talk to folks who've been out of work, say he's going to change things, say coal is coming back, for instance, talked about the carrier conditioner company sending jobs overseas, Ford sending jobs overseas. Easier said than done, though, and these are people who are angry who are expecting him to do something.
Yes, expectations are very high because the main theme of his campaign was that people in Washington weren't listening to middle America, to these people who feel disenfranchised, who feel the pain of the downturn and haven't really recovered from it. So their expectations are very high. Finding answers to these problems, not so easy, because you can bring manufacturing back, but with new technology, the kind of manufacturing that is going to come back may produce more goods, but probably will produce them with fewer people because of newer technologies. So the changes really are more driven by technology than by trade competition. Trade competition can displace some jobs, but technology displaces a lot of jobs and doesn't create as many new jobs for the future as we had anticipated.
Bob Hormetz, thank you so much for coming in this morning. You had 8 reasons to cancel. There's so much going on today, but greatly appreciate it. Ambassador Hormetz, is there a book coming out? I haven't had time,
but I'd like to write one. Since you and I collaborated on our last book, we ought to try another
2022
one.
2022?
But I do think we have to look ahead and think ahead and plan.
Yes.
We've been very tactical as a country, and our governments have been very tactical, looking at the short term. We need a long-term strategy for creating growth and opportunity.
Right.
We can't just react to events of the day.
Bob Hormetz, thank you so much. David Gurr and Tom Keene, Bloomberg Surveillance, thrilled you were with us. David Gurr and Tom Keene, we're picking up the debris after an historic day for America, a nation and a world in shock over our political moment. We are honored to bring you now someone who is in sharp support and strong support for Mr. Trump, Tom Barrack, who's been more than visible with Colony Capital. What you need to know, folks, is he does own the coolest bar in the world, Raffles, over in Singapore. And that is a good and beautiful thing. If you and I were to have a beverage of our choice.
There's only one
Singapore,
choice there.
Yeah. In Singapore today, Tom, I would point out your grandparents came over from Lebanon. How does your president-elect speak to immigrants in America and the people that want to come in?
I think it's simple. I think it's a message of hope, opportunity, and renewal. And I think what you saw last night was a blowout of that immigrant mentality, right, of the beauty of America being a place where if you have the desire, if you have the opportunity, if you have the hard work, you can do it. And we've lost that over the last decade or so. So I think I'm a great example of my grandparents, my parents coming over in the cargo hold of a ship with nothing, and due to the beauty of the American system, had an opportunity to make a living and a life way beyond their dreams for their kids.
Can we get legislation through that it's Republican president, Republican House, Republican Senate? Is it a Republican California? I don't even know. Get legislation finally done on immigration?
I think absolutely so. The Vice President Pence, when you think of the opportunity today, it's immense. You have Trump leadership, and I think you're going to see the cadence of the man now as president much different than the cadence of the man as candidate. The markets will calm. The waters will quiet. And Vice President Pence will have a role that probably no vice president has had in leading and mentoring through that congressional labyrinth.
Did Tom Barrack wake up this morning and look at real estate listings in Washington, D.C.? Are you going to be headed to Washington? We're very curious here sort of what kind of team Donald Trump would assemble, just broadly speaking here. Whom does he hire?
Yeah, I mean, that's the right question, right? Because if you look at President Reagan, a lot of the same questions, right? He was an actor. He was from California, which was a horrible thing. He went to Eureka College, which nobody had heard of. He had no foreign policy experience, and he was divorced. What did he do? He surrounded himself with the best of class cabinet. So he had George Shultz, Cap Weinberger, Richard Allen. I think you're going to see that now happen. Trump has a great transition team. But if you think of who the availability of those candidates were until yesterday, it was more limited because people who would consider it weren't taking it that seriously. So just in the last 12 hours on my iPhone alone, the quality of the candidates who now want to be considered is dramatic. So I think you're going to see great choices of people who understand the system, who have used the system, but are not of the system, so that you can affect that gigantic aircraft carrier of bureaucracy in tiny degrees, not in jolts, but in tiny degrees.
You're a successful businessman. You've heard Donald Trump talk about, say, the Federal Reserve in political terms, terms that he's been criticized for. For those in business who are worried about remarks like that, that they might see as flippant, can you offer some assurance here that he is going to move forward in a very measured way?
Yes. I mean, I think what he was doing before, I analogize it to the UFC cage. He was in a political battle. He is using every known martial arts and slugfest tactic that he can. Now he's president of the United States. Every word that he says reflects global terror, fear, or confidence. And I think you'll see him be much more judicious about what his statements are.
Help me with the Republican Party forward. You grew up in the collegial love fest known as Southern California Republican. What a mess that used to be. Back and forth, you work with Mr. Kalmbach and the personal attorney to President Nixon. How do you perceive the new Republican Party with a different demographic in America? Where do the next Republicans come from?
Yeah, we don't have a deep bench. And I think what we've seen in both parties is a redefinition of everything, of the parties, of the way we analyze social agendas and monetary agendas and fiscal agendas. And when you look at the polling and the exit polling of what happened, what we realize is we have no tools mm-hmm. anymore, right? The tools were totally useless. And I think they're equally useless in both parties. You find people are tired of rhetoric. They want action. A lot of people are very liberal on social issues in the Republican
right.
Party and very conservative on fiscal right. issues, but they don't know what it means.
You own the earthquake-free part of Santa Barbara, California, yeah. as I recall.
Yeah, there's only 2 acres yeah. of it. Yeah.
I didn't hear anything on Green America, climate change. What's the strategy here for something dear to the heart of every Californian? What is President Trump going to do on these huge issues of climate change?
I think it'll evolve, and you know the priorities of the first 100 days, of course, are a little bit like when you're in an airplane and you're losing altitude. The first thing the captain says is take the oxygen mask and put it on.
We do that every morning
to get out of bed.
By the way, I love it. I love it here. You guys have a very cool place, but he doesn't
David
say.
David designed it.
He doesn't say take the mask and put it on your 4 friends and then go across the aisle and put it on 3 other people. And I think that's what you're going to see is those priorities are priorities of an entitled society that needs that focus. But right now we need other focus. And our monetary policy is waning. You're going to see fiscal policy be instilled. You need a new tax code. You need a new health program. You need schooling. Our foreign policy has got to be restabilized. You have an opportunity for a man like Trump with a elegant foreign service bureaucracy to change the fabric of how we deal with the Middle East, of how we deal with China, of how we deal with Russia. It's an opportunity, and it's going to take a very sophisticated team in order to implement all of that at one time.
You've watched your friend Donald Trump go through this here over the last many months, and we have seen a lot written about Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, as somebody who is playing a very active role in the campaign going forward. What kind of role do you see him playing in an administration?
Significant. I mean, Jared is exceptional, as is Ivanka and Donald's other kids. But Jared has a very refined mind, a very soft and consensual approach. And most importantly, Donald trusts him, which for this president is critically important. So I think Jared as an advisor, as a confidant, you'd have to ask Donald what position other than that. But for a young man, he has an old soul and a very sophisticated mind.
I assume you were at the Hilton last night for all the goings-on after the polls closed. There was a moment when Donald Trump beckoned Reince Priebus up to the stage, gave him a big hug. President-elect Donald Trump gave him a big hug and thanked him for it. The symbolism was not lost on me there. This has been at times an uneasy relationship with the Republican Party officials. What's the importance of party allegiance in light of the campaign that we've seen here? Do people have as much allegiance to their parties, be they Republican or Democrat, going forward?
I think the truthful answer is no. Mm. And I think what happened in that alignment was a forced marriage. And what you saw in Donald bringing him up to the stage was, we did it.
Uh-huh.
You may have questioned me getting us here, but I got us here.
Yeah.
And I think he is a, what a capable head of it's a hopeless task being head of the Republican Party under those circumstances when you have a candidate that the party didn't even want in the first place.
Yeah.
Now the man is exceptionally capable. He'd be a great chief of staff. He could roll over into other pieces. But I think exactly as you said, the definition of what is a party, what is the purpose, and do people really vote that way anymore? I think it's a different game.
Can you bring rugby to America?
I hope. Then at least I could get some acclaim.
Did you watch All Blacks in Ireland the other day? It was extraordinary.
No, unbelievable.
Extraordinary.
Isn't it?
I don't know much about it. You did it. You played it at USC. But it was extraordinary, wasn't it?
No, it was. And you know, I look at the election kind of the same way. What I loved about rugby is you go out, you compete to the fullest extent known to mankind, killing each other. And when that whistle blows at the end, they bring out a keg, it's over.
Yeah, what I don't get is you've got a gorgeous face. How do you keep your – this must be all the money got you all the face planks.
I mean, your voice and leg is perfect, but your eyesight must be failing.
Thank you. Yes, it is. And it's, I'm told daily. Tom Barrack, thank you so much. Clearly in support and in early support of your president-elect. He is a former governor of Minnesota, the hockey player from South St. Paul, Tim Pawlenty. Governor, good morning.
Well, thanks for that introduction. I particularly like that one.
Well, thrilled to have you from our 99.1 studios in Washington. It is a different morning for Republicans in Washington. How do they adapt and adjust to their president-elect?
I think fairly easily. I think most of the Republicans, if you look at their wish list, which is make some progress on the debt and the deficit, get tougher with respect to immigration, make sure it's legal as opposed to illegal, try to get some regulatory reform and relief, try to better unleash the American energy sector, fix or repeal Obamacare and more, and you line that up with most of Donald Trump's agenda, there's really good alignment. So I think with a Republican Congress and that sort of president, you could see people get very busy in Washington very quickly.
Governor Pawlenty, you now helm the Financial Services Roundtable there in Washington, D.C. Your constituents, your members are big investors, the heads of big companies. What assurance are they getting this morning from the Trump campaign about a path forward here once he begins the transition?
Well, he hasn't said a lot about financial services in detail, but he said a few things over the course of the campaign. One, during the Republican convention, they put a return to Glass-Steagall, the breaking up of investment and commercial banking into the Republican platform, and his then campaign manager embraced that. I'm not sure how vigorously he'll embrace that as a president. He also said he wants to get rid of Dodd-Frank or at least substantially overhaul it and try to create more lending opportunities. And so that's hopeful from an industry standpoint. He attacked carried interest specifically in a couple of junctures. That really affects more hedge funds than the regulated banks, the group that I represent and lead. He's also talked about the need to provide some relief for small banks and community banks in particular, mid-sized banks. So and the list goes on a little bit. But basically, that's a list that is pretty, I think, would be hopeful from the industry feeling like that they've been overregulated in some respects.
You're in the information business. You're lobbying. You're talking to lawmakers about policy, what you'd like to see, what shape you'd like to see policy take. From what you know of Donald Trump, from what exposure you've had to him here over these last few months, how amenable is he to listening to people like you amid the rhetoric, of course, of draining the swamp of Washington, D.C.?
I think, you know, there's a big difference between what you do on the campaign trail and now the act of governing. And I think it's going to be fair to say, based on the arc of his life and what we saw during the campaign, he's never going to be the kind of person who dives into policy details. Mm-hmm. So I think he's going to set a direction and a tone and then try to trust people around him to build out the details and move it forward. And so who he appoints to these positions is going to be very telling and very impactful and very important.
Governor, I mentioned this morning elections of 1800, of 1916, and of course the history of 1960. You are a Catholic, but you have, with your wife, spent much more time within the evangelical movement. How did Donald Trump gain the evangelical vote with some of the outrages of this campaign? You lived it out in Minnesota. How did he pull that off?
I think Donald Trump is somebody who benefited from his own charisma, his own projection of strength. People wanted and perceived strength. And then there's a whole bunch of people in this country who were either afraid of being disenfranchised or were disenfranchised. And one group of that were people who are concerned about their faith and religious freedom, the future of the Supreme Court. And while they may not have loved Donald Trump's, you know, behavior at certain chapters in his life, they were very much fearful of what Hillary Clinton might do in that regard as it relates to religious freedom, Supreme Court appointments and the like. And they realize those appointments in particular will last and have an impact for 20 or 30 years. And so they, I think, were willing to make some concessions and realize it's an imperfect package, but on balance, they'd rather have Trump for those reasons than Clinton.
Let's turn our attention to your home state, the state of Minnesota. Donald Trump and his campaign saying in the days leading up to the election that the campaign had a real shot of winning that state. Doesn't look like that happened. But what did he see in Minnesota? What did you see him seeing in Minnesota there that that others didn't?
Well, Minnesota has some characteristics of Wisconsin and some of the other Iowa and some of the other Midwestern states, but it also has some things that are, you know, like other parts of the country, like Boston, for example. So we have a big med tech, high tech, more diverse economy, frankly, than some of the other parts of the Midwest. So it's a blend between some of the states that went for Trump and some of the states that went for Clinton. Clinton eked it out, but barely. It was much, much closer than people would have imagined. And he actually, with a little bit more of a boost, could have potentially won it. But Minnesota hasn't voted Republican for president since Richard Nixon. Mm. It's the longest unbroken streak of any state in the nation voting for Democrat for president. And in part, that's because Reagan won all the states and Mondale was on the ballot, and he didn't. He carried Mondale, carried Minnesota.
HHH.
Governor Tim Pawlenty there, former governor of Minnesota, now CEO of the Financial Services Roundtable in Washington, D.C.
Next, Ian Bremmer joins us, of course, with Eurasia Group. He is picking up the debris of the international relations of Eurasia Group with a domestic focus today. Dr. Bremmer, good morning to you. There was a moment where Mexican pesos signaled that Secretary Clinton would do what the elite said, and then things changed. Why did they change at 10 p.m. last night?
Look, I mean, there's no question this comes as a shock to everybody that was watching the polls. You know, I think what happened is not the structural issues aren't different. It's just that they hit harder, right? I mean, you have a population with a very strong anti-establishment sensibility. That's not just about Democratic leadership. It's Republican leadership. It's the mainstream media. You have an economic rebound, but a feeling that that rebound is not getting to lots of people in the middle and working classes. And you also were running the most establishment candidate with a lot of negatives that either side could have put forward. Given all of that, the polls were still showing a very significant Hillary win towards the end. It's about the question of turnout and a lot of people not telling you what they're planning on doing in the polls. Even given that, the United States demographics should have given you a different outcome than what you saw in the UK. That just wasn't the case. And now, of course, you're going to see a dramatically different U.S. foreign policy in the rest of the world.
Ian Bremmer, let's talk a little bit about that policy. We have a situation in Syria that continues to worsen. We have fighting in Mosul once again. We have a relationship with Russia that is fractious, to say the least. What's at the top of the agenda here for President-elect Trump when it comes to foreign policy?
Well, you know, the wall is what he says is at the top of the agenda, but nobody really believes that it's going to get built. I think the things that he talks about and the constraints that he will face in foreign policy will be very great. I mean, Obama was a radical departure from Bush's foreign policy. And yet, if you look at what Obama's foreign policy has actually accounted to over the course of 8 years, you see that in most cases it's not all that different. You still have wars going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. Guantanamo is still open. European relations aren't that great. Israel-Palestine hasn't gotten fixed. I mean, some things happened, of course, in Iran deal. But, you know, if you ask where Trump is going to matter most, he's going to matter most in terms of the fact that every single U.S. ally thinks that he's a disaster for their relationship in the future, thinks that he's not committed to American alliances, thinks he's not committed to American trade, thinks he's not committed to American values. And so, therefore, you're going to see an incredible amount of international hedging away from America, and not towards any single thing. It's an absence of American leadership and an absence of global leadership. And for the Middle East in particular, that means a lot more violence. So, you know, interestingly enough, in Syria is the one place that, given his relationship, his desire to have a closer relationship with Russia, I do think the view will be Assad isn't going anywhere. This is a big win for Assad. And let's just do what we can to get out and keep the fighting off.
We continue with Ian Bremmer of Eurasia Group. David Gura, quickly, a data check. The tape improves, particularly off where we were 10 p.m. into midnight. Futures negative 30, dramatically worse earlier. The Dow, not negative 400, negative 300, negative 232. That's quite an improvement, just over 18,000. Yields come in from where they were, 1.96% on the 10-year yield. David?
Ian Bremmer, last night we heard Donald Trump doing conciliatory as best he could around 3 o'clock in the morning when he delivered his speech at the Hilton here in Midtown Manhattan. He said that the U.S. would be willing to meet with any countries, again, just emphasizing that he wants fair deals with them. Who's going to lead his efforts to engage with other foreign leaders around the world?
Well, so far it's been his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. He's the one that's actually organized the meetings that Trump has had with heads of state. He's been in those meetings individually, and he does have a strong view on foreign policy, clearly wants to play a role. But in terms of who's going to be the Secretary of State or who's going to be, you know, sort of the Secretary of Defense, I mean, frankly, there's no one that's been around Trump that's considered radically credible on those issues. So either he goes for a complete outsider, he takes one of his advisors that, you know, doesn't have experience on these points. I mean, you know, Newt Gingrich would be an obvious choice, or you're going to see him reach out some of the Republican establishment. And on foreign policy, literally everyone in the Republican establishment has said that they're strongly opposed to this guy.
Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? They see their role as to serve, not sell. That's why Charles Schwab is committed to the success of over 7,000 independent financial advisors who passionately dedicate themselves to helping people achieve their financial goals. Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.
David Gura with Tom Keene on the day after Election Day, 2016, the 9th of November, looking at economic indicators here, brought to you by Commonwealth Financial Network. When it's time to change the conversation, talk with a broker-dealer RIA that's ready to listen. Call 866-462-3638 or visit commonwealth.com to learn more. Tom, at 10 o'clock today, wholesale inventories, wholesale trade sales coming out as well tomorrow, looking ahead to initial jobless claims. Suffice to say, the biggest economic indicator is Donald Trump. President-elect Donald Trump and the uncertainty surrounding that, who will be on his cabinet, what his economic policy will look like. That's what we're continuing to follow here this morning. And with that, I want to bring in the Honorable Dick Gephardt, former congressman, former Democratic leader, joining us now by phone. He is now the president and CEO of the Gephardt Group. And Congressman Gephardt, bring to bear your experience governing in the minority when you have such a majority of the other party in Washington D.C. Take us back to 1994. How useful is it to look at that when you're looking at the way things shook out last night?
Well, I think it is useful to look at history always and experience. That was a tumultuous election. We lost the House for the first time in 40 years, so it was a big, devastating loss to Democrats, just like this is today for Democrats. But it's a great country, and we have to move forward together, and you have to make decisions. And, you know, I always remind people that in that period after 94, you know, the Republicans shut down the government twice, and they impeached President Clinton. And in the midst of all that, we were solving problems. We balanced the budget. We got welfare reform done. So you can do these things even in the midst of lots of disagreement and difficulty. And that's kind of the story of democracy. You know, it's a substitute for violence. Our ancestors put 535 people in the room, not one. And that means you got to work hard every day, but among that group and with the president to get hard things done, to resolve those inevitable conflicts that come on policy between this vast, diverse country.
Congressman Gephardt, what happens to the anger that we have seen on the campaign trail here? You mentioned the 435 members of Congress. Were there proxies for that anger? How does that play out?
Well, it's a real problem, but again, you have to deal with what you've got. There were a lot of grievances, in my view, that were expressed last night. It's wrong, I think, to make all the statements about what was being expressed. I think a lot of different things were being expressed. Economic grievances, gender grievances, social grievances, racial grievances, and a lot of others. And so there was a lot of anger out in the country for a variety of reasons that got expressed. The people make the decision. And so the people that got elected have a duty, a responsibility to come to Washington and try painstakingly, which it always is, to find compromises that can allow the country to move forward. That's their job, and that's what they need to do.
Mr. Gephardt, it has been a tumultuous 2 weeks. I guess the election counts is a smaller item than the Chicago Cubs winning. And, you know, I don't know what that means to a gentleman from St. Louis.
Yeah.
But I give us a perspective on how truly your St. Louis has changed over the years. It's a changed America. It is a different America. This was to happen. That was to happen. All the pundits got it wrong. How has your St. Louis changed over the ensuing years?
Well, there's so much change, it's hard to know where to start. First of all, when I was growing up in the 50s in St. Louis, it was a Midwestern industrial town. We had big corporation headquarters. We had lots of jobs. My dad was a milk truck driver. It delivered milk door to door. He didn't get through high school. And he used to always say to me, you know, you have clothes on your back, you have, we're in the middle class, he used to say, because I'm in a union that gets me fair wages for my hard work. That was the world I grew up in. That world is gone, and now you're into a completely different world from all aspects. Our economy has changed dramatically in the last 40, 30, 40, 50 years. Our information revolution is to me bigger than the Industrial Revolution, and that's changed everything, disrupted everything. And you've got a more multiracial society than we had. Women have obtained many more abilities to do things in the economy and in our society. So there's a lot of, you know, really earth-moving change that's gone on, and in a way, this election and some past elections have been a reaction to a lot of that change.
We have a minute left only, sir. From our studios in Washington, how does your Democratic Party regroup? What do you need to see from the present leadership, Speaker Pelosi and such?
Well, I think both parties are faced with grappling with all of this change and the grievances that were expressed.
Agreed, yeah.
And so, you know, in our primary for president, we had the Bernie Sanders effect, and that expressed a lot of these grievances that are out there. And I guess you can say we've got to deal with that. The Democratic Party has to get back in touch with working class Americans. They've got to really address, I think most importantly, the Democrats have to be able to address with the Republicans these urgent issues that are in front of us as a country, and work with Republicans as best they can to find those magic compromises that allow us to move forward.
He is Gephardt from St. Louis. Mr. Gephardt, thank you so much from our studios in Washington this morning, 99.1 FM. You know, this is remarkable, David. I mean, I just can't say enough about the guests we're having and truly the shock of this moment for all, including the supporters of Mr. Trump.
Unexpected by many, but yeah, we're going to speak with another one. David Malpass will be joining us shortly.
Shot near North Carolina last night from 18-ish up to record weakness 20.50 on Mexican peso, a little better recovery through the morning, given Mr. Trump's speech, et cetera. But we've just had a new leg up in peso. It'll be interesting to see if we break through to new weakness. For all Americans, I really can't convey enough a careful read of always wonderful Michael Barone at the American Enterprise Institute. If you are the most diehard Bernie Sanders supporter or a supporter of Secretary Clinton and obviously Republican, peruse his November 5th essay on royalist America. It is really something. He leaves no candidates unscarred. Joining us now, we are honored to have with us Secretary Malpass. No. Oh, excuse me. I'm trying to get a...
OMB director, I think.
David, congratulations on your economic instincts and your persistency of advocating a Republican Party policy around the candidate you were dealt. When did you become a Trump supporter?
Hi, Tom. Good morning. And David, I don't think that's the right way to think about this. Donald Trump is very strongly knowledgeable about where he wants to take the country. And that's what drove this. It wasn't people creating the plan. It was him saying, look, taxes.
Okay, fair.
Remember the knowledge of the tax code. The tax code is really screwed up. So that was a principal focus of the campaign, and so on down the list.
Some would have suggested if he released his taxes, maybe we would have been able to focus on the code.
Okay, but school choice is a really important thing to Americans.
Yes.
He identified that, talked about it a lot, and did these lots of addresses on policy change. So we ought to look at it that way.
Can he affect policy now that the strategy has been led to victory?
I think so, definitely. And so look at the Republican House and Senate. That's going to be a critical aspect of this. I liked last night how he reached out to lots of people, to foreign countries,
yes,
saying America's going to be fair for everyone. He reached out to Reince Priebus. And so these were strong ways to bring people together. House and Senate will be critical in policy implementation. A lot of stuff he can do through leadership. Mm-hmm. And Americans in the exit polls yesterday were saying, above all, they want a strong leader, and he's showing that, and also, I think, showed a very good speech last night to bring people together.
David Malpass, you have served in federal government.
Excuse
Donald Trump
me,
very
Secretary Malpass.
No, please, you guys. That's not right at all.
We'll talk to him tomorrow and see what the story
Go
is.
Ahead.
You've served in government. Donald Trump very proudly has not served in government. If you had a few minutes with him to talk about what he needs to know going into running the federal government, what would you say?
Again, that's not the way it works. He knows a lot about how government operates. He's been watching government and thinking about how it should be done. He's already said that he wants a business-like government, that the way the government's been operating is sloppy. It doesn't work. It's very costly. So we know one of the things he'll want to do is bring very qualified people into positions and allow them to operate the way he does in his business enterprises.
We joke about you being Secretary Malpass, but are you convinced here that there are Republicans, establishment Republicans, others who will take the call when Donald Trump calls, offering them positions in his government, who may not have supported him here on the campaign trail?
I don't mean to be cynical, but there are a lot of people who would like to help who weren't helping before. And so I think there is going to be a need for everybody in the country to kind of pull together. And there are millions of people not in the labor force. We've talked about this a lot. And that need jobs, need to have small businesses that create new investments. Right. Everybody has to pull together.
You are the physicist from Colorado College. I want to now go over the physics of something complex. Steve Roach mentioned this yesterday before this shocking election. David Malpass, explain the physics of dynamic scoring. It's hugely controversial. People have beat you, Wilbur Ross, and others up, Peter Navarro. Tell me why the critics of Malpass dynamic scoring are wrong.
Dynamic scoring simply means that the economy changes when you change policy. It's dynamic. And so we know that if you put in a better tax code, people are going to work harder. They're going to invest more. There's a divide in the parties. Sometimes Democrats say, oh, no, people won't work more. They'll work less because they're getting more take-home pay. That's not actually the way it works. When you have lower rates on a broader base, as Ronald Reagan Reagan did, you got more business involvement and more hiring, more people that wanted to advance. And the median income went up very rapidly. That's dynamic
scoring. Can you model that into the portfolio and into the plugins and predictions at CBO, for example, before the fact? Or does President Trump and his administration have to wait, as everyone else does, till after the fact?
One way to do numbers is to say, if we grow 4%, what happens to revenues? And so if you keep revenues constant as a percentage of GDP as you accelerate the GDP, it actually turns out that the debt-to-GDP ratio starts going down. If you then project that to the business community, say, look, things are getting better from the government's debt standpoint, they're going to invest more. And so you end up with a dynamic business investment environment that creates jobs like crazy. So, and Mr. Trump knew that from the beginning. He said, well, it's not just 4%. There can be more than that. I know there can
be. Yeah, but the question,
25 million jobs.
The distinction here, using a phrase from President Obama, is the hope and audacity of modeling the success before you get that payoff from fiscal policy.
Exactly.
Am I right?
Well, yeah. But if you model stagnation, then businesses aren't going to invest. My current Forbes column, which I think is on newsstands, says that straight out.
When you do a shameless plug like that, when you're a secretary, let it pass.
Available on newsstands now.
There you go. David Valpass, before you went to Colorado Springs, you were in Northern Michigan. Looking at the election results last night, Donald Trump carrying Michigan, the first time a Republican has done that since 1988, he tapped into something there. We were talking about the burden of expectations earlier. A lot of rhetoric here about Ford sending jobs to Mexico, the Carrier air conditioning company sending jobs out of the country as well. You've got people now who are expecting action. How is Donald Trump going to deliver?
Yeah, so I grew up in a very small town in blue collar iron foundry country, and so it's very challenging for American workers to see iron coming in from India, castings that are landed in Michigan at a lower cost than what could possibly be produced in the U.S. And so Trump was able to explain that to Americans, that the system, the global government system that we've been operating under, right, hasn't worked for Americans. I think there can be constructive changes, and he reached out to everybody in the world yesterday and said, let's make this work.
I want to bring this morning. Well, nobody knows that with a sleep deprived. Secretary Malpass, I want to bring up one name. We're trying to avoid the guessing of the administration, but there is one name that has served this nation. You and I know him quite well, and that is Roger Ferguson. Is it time for Mr. Ferguson to re-enter the political maelstrom and serve the nation again?
He was a great Fed vice chair. I really don't have comments on personnel. President-elect Trump has said that he's going to reach out to the best, most talented. He used a Kennedy phrase, I think, last night, best and brightest, to make the country grow again and great again. And so certainly anyone who can contribute to that, there is the need for them to do it, either in their own business or in government, both ways. Mm. We need a government that's working effectively for the American people. We haven't had that, and that can be repaired.
David, congratulations on the wisdom of this election from the eyes of the Malpass.
Congrats to Trump. Think how hard he worked every day for 2 years, giving speech after speech to explain this to the biggest part of the American public.
David Malpass, thank you so much. William Sima at Global, and an early supporter of the economics of President-elect Trump. It is a most odd market. It is uncorrelated, and it is levels in search of new levels. Yields 11 basis points higher, 1.97%. As we mentioned earlier, the probability of Fed action coming in decisively off the Bloomberg on December, 50-50 roughly. Right now, green on the screen, the Dow up 68 points, but stocks going this way and that. David Wilson, of course, mentioning the hospital stocks crushed off of Thoughts on the Affordable Care Act. We afford a good time to speak with Mohammed El Arian. It is wonderful to speak to him. Of course, publishing in the FT a bit ago. Dr. El Arian, good morning. Your book, When Markets Collide, Change the Language of Game Theory, page 280. Pascal's wager applies to a situation in which there is a small probability of an event that has an enormous consequence. Thank you for predicting the Trump election.
Good morning, Tom. Tom, it's just one of a long list of improbables, if not unthinkables, that have become reality. And it's the system telling us something, which is if you run advanced economies at low speed for a long time, and if this low speed is non-inclusive, things break.
My chart of the year is real GDP down 40-some percent on a rate basis from 4-point-some percent to 2.1% back 30 years or so, and it really speaks to the slowdown. What policy prescription can there be to jumpstart this economy to the quoted Trump number of 4%?
So the good news is there's pretty broad-based consensus in the profession that you need to move on four things. One, pro-growth structural reforms, such as corporate tax reform. Two, a more balanced demand management, including infrastructure spending on fiscal side. Three, deal with the debt problems in Greece and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And finally, better global policy coordination. So there is an engineering solution. It's whether the politics will implement it.
You grew up in a house of diplomacy, Dr. El Arian. You have an esteemed British education where game theory is a cottage industry. What should be the game theory of Mr. Trump as he moves from movement, as he called it in his acceptance speech, to the reality of executing politics? What's the change agent he needs within Donald Trump's game theory?
So I think it's to move quickly in areas that can have an immediate positive impact and where there is broad-based agreement. So he has promised, for example, infrastructure spending, corporate tax reform, raising the tax on carried interest, deregulation. If he moves quickly on this but refrains from moving on other things he's promised, particularly protectionism, slapping tariffs on China and Mexico, breaking up NAFTA, if he was to able to do this combination and communicate it as he did at 2:30 this morning in a conciliatory fashion, he could get positive momentum. Mm-hmm.
Two themes to speak of in our final minutes with you this morning. Can Prime Minister May avoid a hard Brexit? The language of Parliament seems to be towards moderation. Is that feasible within the British system?
It is feasible. She can avoid a hard Brexit. Right now, things have moved towards a softer Brexit and a longer Brexit process. So clearly there is a way out, but the politics, again, are complicated. And we haven't even spoken about what's happening with the Italian referendum. Politics will remain a big issue on your show, Tom, in the weeks and months to come.
We'll see that. We had wonderful perspective. Thank you to Richard Haass and Robert Hormats for perspective this morning. Finally, Dr. El Arian, to your Egypt, the depreciation, the unpegging, if you will, of the Egyptian pound was extraordinary. How does the El-Sisi government, whatever you want to phrase it as a government, how do they deal with a black market Egyptian pound, the effect of that upon the people of Cairo in Egypt?
So first and foremost, they need to protect the most vulnerable segment of the population. And the program that they've agreed to with the IMF attempts to do that. Secondly, they need to promote higher growth quickly. And there are the reforms. And thirdly, they have to make sure that the exchange system works properly. This is probably the most comprehensive reform program that Egypt has put together, and there's commitment from the very top to its implementation. So it's going to be really critical for them to follow through and for them to get the external assistance that the program assumes.
But doesn't it assume domestic reform as well? And can the El-Sisi government do that? Can they domestically reform away from international rulemakers like Madame Lagarde and the IMF?
So what they're hoping to do is to reform with the support of the international community and implement a program that they have stressed is designed in Egypt for Egypt, but needs the support of the outside world. That is the approach that's being adopted, and we will see as the various components come together and whether they're sustained or not.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Alarian, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it. Mohammed Alarian, folks, I can't say enough about his more recent book as well, and frankly becomes ever more interesting given the political festivities of the last 24 hours. Just truly, truly extraordinary. Mohammed Alarian, of course, writing often for Bloomberg View. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keen. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.